First, let me introduce Adele Buckley, who will be starting us today. Adele Buckley is a physicist, an aerospace engineer, and an environmental scientist. She's also the past chair of the Canadian Pugwash Group and is our member on the International Pugwash Council and a presenter at many Pugwash conferences. She has a PhD in aerospace engineering and a master's of science in honors in physics, an honorary doctorate from the University of Toronto, and her field of science is innovative technology from concept to full commercialization. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Adele Buckley.
Thank you, Steve. I'm really pleased to have a chance to talk about this topic because I think it's a really interesting topic and has some particular resonance in Canada. And the future, I'm going to try to set the stage, if you like, for the proper nuclear weapon-free zone discussion, to just talking about what's going on in the Arctic and why it's there. Okay, I want you to think about this map. We can bring it back off and on. But this is, if you look at it from the North Pole, this is the North Pole, and all of the surrounding states, you know, Canada, as you could see it, the U.S. in Alaska, a huge periphery of the Arctic Ocean with the Soviet Union. We also have a little tiny bit of Iceland, and we also have the Norway Denmark as nations on the Arctic Ocean, and then Arctic nations above the Arctic Circle, and that's what we're talking about here as Arctic, also Sweden and Finland. So those are the circumpolar nations. Okay, so can everyone hear me? Now that you finished looking at the map, so this is what we want to be thinking about. The first thing, the polar ice is melting because there is climate change, or vice versa. The polar ice melting also causes climate change. I mean, what happens in the Arctic is not isolated from the entire rest of the world. The land, the sea, the ice, they're all part of what makes the climate right here today and all over the world. So it's not just them. And furthermore, what are we supposed to do about this as a global community? Adapt? Cooperate? We hope so. But, you know, there's other forces at work, so we must kind of think about that. Now, I'm sure you've been reading the newspapers, but just think about this. The annual ice cover has disappeared very, very rapidly. Now, I don't have a pointer here, so I guess you'll just have to look at the picture. But the fact is that we've got data up to, say, 2000, and there's a big periphery there of lots of ice. Then there's 2005, and then there's 2007, and it keeps disappearing. But that's just the ice that's going away. If you look more closely at it, you discover, and what's happening is there's multi-year ice and the big thick stuff and the single-year ice. And there's a lot more of the one-year ice. That means it melts in the summer and it disappears, and then it comes back in the winter. So that just looking at ice cover isn't the whole story. There's a lot more to think about there. And when you lose a lot of multi-year ice, you're definitely on the way to losing the Arctic ice. Now, we know that we're going to get navigation in the summer Arctic seas, but that's a huge challenge. Now, there's two ways of going across the new Mediterranean, as some would have called it, or there's the Northwest Passage, and in Canada we've all heard a lot about that, so we can kind of relate to that. But there's also the Northern Sea Route. That's the route, back a little bit. Maybe we should just have the. The Northern Sea Route is, in fact, across essentially the Soviet Union route, and that's the already more kind of developed. Anyway, you would get then, because of that, offshore oil production, industrial transport, all on this huge, gigantic Arctic Ocean. You'd have to have a support network, ports, well-spaced, well-equipped. Some of them are in process, but not in the Canadian Arctic. Navigation charts, coastal pilots, surveillance of ice conditions, lots of things necessary. Emergency services, shipping controls, regulations. You need to have search and rescue. You need to be dealing with oil spills. You need to have ice-capable ships and experienced crews to run them. And so we've got this sort of gigantic environmental challenge, how to maintain the Arctic Ocean and the shores in a pristine state. So not only that, we have also, the consequences of Arctic climate change are simply, I think I've lost my place, but I'll find, yeah, here it is. Well, of course, it's a new frontier for resource development and exploration. Lots of commercial interest there. There's the international law of the sea, which will resolve sovereignty claims on the continental shelves. I'm sure you'll hear more about that, I'm sure, from the others. And navigation routes open in summer seas. Commercial shipping, new opportunities for tourism. The fisheries will change and there'll be commercial shipping. Habitat and species and complex food supply webs will totally change. And they'll change it so rapidly that it's hard to cope. Ocean shores will change. Lakes, rivers, glaciers will alter. And coastal flooding will make a lot of the areas that are presently inhabited uninhabitable. So, and wildlife habitat will all change. And permafrost melting, if you want to really start worrying about this, will accelerate production of greenhouse gases and cause massive infrastructure problems on, say, like pipelines, which are, you know, destroyed by permafrost problems. And everybody in that Arctic circumpolar group is likely to increase their military presence. Meaning of that is to be determined. Now, so if we then think of just one example, fisheries and marine life. It's a new hazardous frontier for commercial shipping. The extent of the fishery stock is, in fact, unknown. Conditions for the nutrients, not uniform. Overfishing is entirely possible, just like other oceans will be overfished. I mean, yes, there's lots of fish there, but where are they and which are the good areas? And then there will be lots of new species and new diseases and temperature changes and acidity increases. And so generally, this is a kind of difficult situation. I'm going to give you one example here of don't seem to be really good at. I keep going backwards. Sorry. I told you really what will happen in the habitat and food supply. Not to mention that tree lines won't advance like you think they might. There's a big issue about whether there's any Arctic soils of interest. Adaptation is the big thing. I mean, we all hear talk about going to Copenhagen and doing mitigation things. Well, of course, this helps over a sort of longer term, but what happens over the short term? Things that are happening now and in the relatively near future, this is a big adaptation situation. So it requires huge resources. And the Arctic peoples, of course, need to have some support in that work that's being done. Essentially, you need jointly developed things by Arctic peoples and their governments. You have to think about sustainability paramount. You have to think there will be environmental refugees from coastal regions. That's another adaptation from sea culture to land culture. Youth in that area will have to be educated to a totally different kind of way of living. Territorial jurisdiction will have to require indigenous peoples to plan for increased military presence, and traditional knowledge can hopefully be used. Now, I'm giving you one example of adaptation, which is a brand new, and I just sort of discovered this in recent times, a sort of interesting picture on the trails of the Inuit. Apparently, what happened here is that there was a thought that you could provide GPS for hunters that are going out in huge territories in Nunavut. And in fact, the GPS had attached to their snowmobiles or their dog sleds. And as it started with kind of University of Calgary, and it started somewhat with a polar ice year and others. And we find that they had a terrifically interesting experience in taking these small GPS units out into the polar regions. But it took, they started in 2006. The first fielding of a six-month trial was 2008. 2009, they had learned a whole lot of stuff in 2008, and maybe 2009 they're working on it, and now what they've got is over time an extremely valuable way of finding out where are the caribou, where's the weak ice, where are all sorts of weather conditions, all sorts of important stuff that they use and the scientific community uses together. So the lesson about this is you need northerners, southerners together. It takes longer than you think, and you have to keep on supporting it. And you need lots of resources. And Steve has told me I should hurry up, but I'm not too far from the end, I think. A couple of pictures of Arctic research taking place in Norway. But just think, whatever's happening, it will. The harsh environment requires major adaptations of new technologies. Don't underestimate what will happen there. And so this will really change things. And at the same time, there's a lot of activity in increased military operations. And so, of course, sovereign territory protection and work on that can actually be helpful in opening the Arctic if that was the slant on things. But the two circumpolar nations are, as you remember from the map, are Arctic nations, and they're also nuclear weapons nations. This makes it really difficult because the other nuclear weapon-free zones have not had quite such horrendous challenges with respect to that. But if they went forward to that, it would be a major step in an indication of true intent in nuclear disarmament. So it's a new frontier, new challenges. Military conflict really needs to be renounced because there are other things that are much more important to be doing in the Arctic. I just wanted to quote Franklin Griffith, who is here today, and he has a lot of information about the Arctic in many papers that he's written, but I think one of the observations he made, should change favor conflict, the region as a whole will suffer, and risks of strategic rivalry and all manner of collaboration will be foregone. So we don't really want that. And we see that we could have an expanded mandate for the Arctic Council. We could expand programs for adaptation. We could necessarily have lots more scientific data, and you could have a scientific commission on the Arctic research. Antarctic has such a thing. The UN Law of the Sea will be continuing to operate its major for this, and agreements can be regional or national or even Arctic Treaty, but apparently the Arctic polar nations are not very interested in Arctic Treaty. They think that it would be interference with their own work. Concluding, the climate affects the global climate. That's all there is to it. And adaptation is a massive challenge. And we need huge international resources to bring forward and to get this successful opening of the Arctic. And humanity simply doesn't possess the funds or the resources or the people to do both. So doing, we have to choose not military and not not conflict, because that's not going to be possible to do both. And so we need collaboration. And what we need, if at all possible, is the seeds of planting a nuclear weapon-free zone every time an agreement is made about anything, whether it be environmental or some other topic. It should also include the idea that sooner or later it will be a nuclear weapon-free zone. I think you could put the map back up. I'll back it up.
That's great. That's great. Thank you so much, Adele. Adele and I had the pleasure of being invited to attend a conference in Copenhagen this summer, and the organizers, the Danish Institute for Strategic Studies, had a very good relationship with the U.S. Embassy there, and the U.S. Embassy offered to take Adele and I and another academic on a five-hour flight from Copenhagen, practically straight up all the way to Thule at the very top of Greenland, where you know the U.S. has its very highest air base, the Ballistic Missile Early Warning Station, the big radar that scans the skies over Russia looking for missile launches. Actually, anywhere around the world, even during the Gulf War, this facility was used to look for Scud launches there. 5 hours up, we had a tour for 90 minutes on the ground by the commanding officer, hundreds of U.S. personnel there and Danish contractors working at full pace, upgrading the radar system to work with the U.S. ballistic missile defense system. A very busy place it was, only 900 miles from the Arctic Circle, which was, or from the, sorry, 900 miles from the North Pole. We were well beyond the Arctic Circle, only 900 miles from the North Pole. So that was, it was kind of funny because the offer went out to all of the people attending the conference, and most people said, 5 hours on a plane for 90 minutes on the ground and then 5 hours back? Are you crazy? Of course not. And of course we said, well, when do we leave? Our hands went right up. Say, who's going to miss a chance like that? So it was quite an experience. If you Google on YouTube and look for BMEWS or BMUS Thule, you can see a little 40-second video that we shot up at the top there. I now want to invite our next speaker to come up and to address this topic. Actually, Mike is going to be doing it from his location here. Professor Michael Wallace is a professor emeritus from the University of British Columbia, and he's had previous visiting professorships at the University of Michigan and L'École des Hautes Études Internationales. He's currently the coordinator of the Canadian Pugwash Group's Arctic Security Working Group, and he's the author of many publications on nuclear weapons and accidental nuclear war, the nuclear fuel cycle, ballistic missiles defenses, and other weapon systems, including nuclear weapons-free zones. Please join me in welcoming Michael Wallace.
Thank you. I'm just checking to see if everyone can hear me all right? Good. Okay. My presentation this afternoon is based on a much longer paper that Steve and I collaborated in writing, it's just basically we're calling it remarks because it's not organized enough really to be a full paper yet. It's on the website for this conference, zeronuclearweapons.com, and I invite you to take a look at the whole thing because of necessity, since I've got 10 minutes, I've got to cut down an awful lot out. My starting point is simply that there is an increasing amount of military buildup in the Arctic littoral and, of course, under the ocean. The melting ice offers access to trade routes and, of course, even more important, ultimately, to the undersea resources, oil and various minerals. Now, the nations are very busy staking claims. We've all seen articles about Russia's rather dramatic gestures of flag planting and so on. The little tiff between Canada and Denmark about Hans Island, the Northwest Passage, which I'm going to leave to my much more learned colleague in international relations, national law over here, Michael Byers. The point is the military competition in the Arctic littoral is increasing. There's no question about that. Now, what we want to do is not so much that the immediate competition is right now staring us in the face of possibly creating a war, but there is a danger once you start a military buildup that a military buildup will get a classic arms tension spiral going. And that's always a risk, and therefore you want to nip it in the bud. You don't want to start let it get to the point where you've got to undo a whole bunch of stuff. It's much better if you get to it right away. And the idea of an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone is part of that, as I'll show. As a matter of fact, that's why in 2007 the Canadian Pugwash Group called for an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, quite a number of other organizations, especially in the Nordic countries, have been very supportive of this. Not so much, obviously, in the two major nuclear weapon states, which unfortunately represent between them the largest barriers to having an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone. Obviously, the Russian Federation deploys a very large number of ballistic missile submarines in the Arctic. It is it's the place where its patrol boxes, as they call them, are for the most part. About two-thirds of their fleet is in the Northern Fleet in the Arctic, the other third in the Pacific, and certainly all of their newest submarines are in the Northern Fleet. The Northern Fleet is based inside the Arctic Circle and comprises a ring of institutions near and around the Kola Peninsula, bases and so on. I don't have a good map of it, but looking at this here, you can see the Kola Peninsula near around Murmansk and Arkhangelsk, the two major populated areas, and there are an awful lot of nuclear installations of various types, nuclear weapons storage areas, and so on. But it's not only the Russian Federation that's an obstacle here. The United States is also an obstacle in the sense that although it is also an Arctic state by virtue, as you can see, of Alaska. It is very unlikely to want to participate, at least at this point, in a nuclear weapons-free zone. That's never been part of its way of looking at nuclear weapons and its position in the world. Not only is it unlikely to participate, it's also likely in some ways, as at least in the past it has been, to hinder the participation of others in a nuclear weapons-free zone, because most of the other Arctic states, besides the two nuclear weapons states, are members of NATO, and as members of NATO, you can turn that back. I think I don't need it. As members of NATO, they of course are bound by the NATO strategic concept, and the NATO strategic concept has nuclear weapons as a front and center, as a crucial part of the NATO treaty, and the guarantee under Article 5 being ultimately, if necessary, backed up by the use of nuclear weapons. Consequently, the United States has a very, very dim view of member nations of NATO participating in non-nuclear things, zones and so on, still maintains rather ludicrously a number of tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, the purpose of which completely escapes me, but nevertheless, they're there. And since they're there, the United States doesn't like changing them, or at least hasn't until now. And in much the same way, the United States is likely to resist, at least at the moment, is likely to resist a denuclearization treaty that comprises the entire polar area and consists, whose members are almost entirely members of NATO. That's not likely to be something it Israel will be happy about. Then also, of course, there's the dispute between Canada and the United States over the Northwest Passage, and I will simply defer to Michael Byers over that, because he just finished writing a book about it. He knows a heck of a lot more than I do, so I'll just let that go. The question then becomes, if you want to have an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, how to do it? And I think the first answer would have to be as part of a general arms control, part of a general arms control agreement between the Russian Federation and the United States. In other words, the only way to get nukes out of the Arctic will be to have fewer nukes. The only way that the Russians would even remotely be tempted or might possibly accept notion of denuclearizing its Arctic would be if the number of nuclear weapons were on both sides were drawn down to a very considerably lower fraction of what they are now. I've got some numbers and stuff in here, and of course you're all familiar with those numbers, so I won't go ahead with it. Obviously a lower overall number of nuclear weapons would make everything easier, but there's a huge number of unknowns here, because we don't know at the moment exactly. We've got some educated guesses and we've got some inside rumors about how the negotiations between the Russian Federation and the United States are going. We don't know exactly, although we've got some rumors about how the Pentagon's going to come up with their nuclear posture review. What we do know, however, and what is very encouraging, we do know that President Obama is personally and deeply committed to large-scale denuclearization of not only with regard to the United States and the Russian Federation, but also the globe in general, and the notion of he takes Article 6 very, very seriously, and he wants to go ahead with it. But of course, in the United States, the president cannot act alone in these matters. There's a lot of other players from the Pentagon to Congress and so on. However, if Obama prevails and if the total number of warheads and launchers is reduced substantially, then the incentive for the Russian Federation to maintain large numbers of nuclear weapons in its own Arctic littoral will be reduced considerably. So that's one way we can approach it, one way it could be approached as part of and as an integral part of a general movement towards whole-scale nuclear disarmament, especially between the two largest nuclear powers. Okay, well, if we can't get that immediately and we don't know what the probabilities are yet, we will probably within a few months or certainly 6 months or so, I imagine. But if we, regardless of that, we can still go ahead and take some baby steps, if you will, to move slowly and gradually towards an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone. One thing we could do would be to have agreements to keep ports nuclear-free. That can be done unilaterally by states. They can say, we do not want any nuclear cargoes in our ports. A number of states have already done that in different contexts. We can also start, of course, with the smaller and medium states and gradually add more. There's no reason why everybody has to all join at once. And we can probably get started with some combination of Denmark and Canada and Iceland, Norway and Sweden, perhaps not Canada under the current government, but under perhaps a little more flexible and less totally pro-American government than we have now. And also parliamentarians for nuclear disarmament have suggested that everyone put pressure on the two nuclear Arctic nuclear weapons states. If they're not prepared to agree to a nuclear weapons-free zone, at least agree to provide negative security guarantees for the Arctic region. That is, they would agree not to attack a non-nuclear weapon state in the Arctic region, even if they're not prepared to participate fully. That would be a big step forward all by itself. It would reduce the incentive to militarize by a considerable amount. Steve, how am I doing for time? Okay, quickly then. All right. The notion has been up until now then that small and medium states have to kowtow to the major nuclear weapon states in these kinds of matters. And I think, to quote Bob Dylan, early Bob Dylan from my youth, the times they are a-changin'. The willingness of small states to go along with the Cold War detritus and idiocies of the major states is rapidly diminishing. We see this, of course, more in Europe than we do in Canada, but it's certainly happening. And a greater willingness then to challenge the rickety old structure of the Cold War, even more fundamentally, and I think this is where we've got to get to ultimately, is a challenge to the entire Westphalian paradigm as a way to operate and grow in the Arctic. The notion of states competing militarily and the war of all against all, which the Westphalian paradigm implies. We've got to move away from that, and I think most people who are serious about the Arctic and things around the Arctic do believe that that's the way we have to operate and grow, is to ditch the old state versus state model of interaction towards a more cooperative, multinational, more generally cooperative model. Sorry, I didn't end very well there, but my time's up, so I'll stop. You can ask questions, and the paper, as I said, is on the website. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Actually, I think there's some copies of the paper being distributed around. So as a bonus to the first people who got back from lunch, I think they all got a copy. If you're a little bit later, then we'll be able to download one off the what was the website again, Meta? It's
zeronuclearweapons.com.
Okay, terrific. And so you can get the whole copy then. Well, thank you, Mike. And, of course, Mike and I, our history goes way back, both having Mike being from the West Coast and me working for In the Arms Race for many years at West. And Mike was always central in the Nanus conversion campaign, which confronted U.S. submarines in that other passage of water, the Georgia Strait, just off of Vancouver, which I think was largely successful. I don't know that there's been many submarines actually traveling up through that area anymore. Since those days,
they
so we
won
do
the
make
principle,
access.
But we won the result. Really, there's hardly anybody.
It was a de facto victory. Many years of committed people there campaigning on that. I'm very pleased to introduce our third speaker, Professor Michael Byers from the University of British Columbia. Michael is also a member of the Canadian Pugwash Group. He's also a member of my own board of the Rideau Institute. And he holds the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at the University of British Columbia. His work focuses on issues of Arctic sovereignty, climate change, the law of the sea, and Canada-U.S. relations. And he leads a project on the Northwest Passage and the Arctic Ocean seabed for ArcticNet, which is a very important organization, federally funded consortium of scientists from 27 Canadian universities and five federal departments working together to deal with these issues. As I mentioned, he's the author, and Michael as well mentioned that Michael Byers has a new book out. It's called Who Owns the Arctic? Unfortunately, we weren't able to, there's a non-commercial clause here, so we weren't able to make copies available to everybody, but they are available through Chapters and Amazon online. I was part of the launch for the book in Ottawa a few weeks ago. Jack Layton was there. Certain Senator Eggleton was there, who I think used to have a name tag maybe around here at one time. as well as numerous MPs and a number of journalists from the Globe and Mail, just underscoring the importance of the research and the interest in this topic. Please join me in welcoming Professor Michael Byers.
Thank you, Steve. It's wonderful to be here, particularly at a time when one can actually speak somewhat optimistically about the prospects for global disarmament. The times are changing. I'm very pleased to see Franklin Griffith in the room, because I'm going to refer to Frank on a couple of occasions. And the first is right now. Frank has warned about purveyors of polar peril. And there are, as our colleague from Stanford pointed out this morning, purveyors of polar peril and proponents of greater tension between Russia and NATO who reside in Moscow. And there are similar people who reside in the United States and, yes, indeed, in this country as well. And we have to take their warnings of prospects for conflict with a large grain of salt. The news in the Arctic is mostly good news when it comes to cooperation, and in particular relations with Russia. And it's bad news with respect to climate change. And to a much lesser but still relevant degree, it's bad news with respect to threats from non-state actors. But the Cold War has been over for several decades now. And Russia, in the Arctic at least, has been playing a mostly constructive role. Best example I can give of this is that Russia, together with the United States, Canada, Denmark, and Norway, the Arctic Ocean coastal states, in May of 2008 signed the Ilulissat Declaration, whereby Russia and those other countries, again including the United States, committed to working within the framework of international law, most notably the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, to peacefully determine who had sovereign rights over which areas of Arctic Ocean seabed, and to ensure that any overlapping claims were resolved according to the rule of law. I'm pleased to report as well that the legal advisors from those five countries' foreign ministries met in September, and a proposal was on the table and remains on the table for those countries to submit coordinated claims to the United Nations Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. Of course, Russia not only has its own purveyors of polar peril, Russia also has its domestic politics. And so, yes, the deputy chair of the Russian Duma did lead an expedition in the summer of 2007 to plant a titanium Russian flag on the floor of the Arctic Ocean at the North Pole. The Russian foreign minister later admitted that it was purely a publicity stunt and that the deputy speaker did not have the permission of the Kremlin. But there was a Russian election underway. Incidentally, the North Pole is on the high seas, and there was nothing illegal about the Russian action, even if it was mildly provocative, or from the perspective of then Canadian Foreign Minister Peter MacKay, highly provocative, but that then gets into issues of Canadian politics in terms of his reaction. A lot of good news when it comes to cooperation in the Arctic. And yes, there can be more. When the idea of a comprehensive Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone was brought to my attention a couple of years ago, I was pretty skeptical. Skeptical for a number of reasons, including the fact that the Russian Northern Fleet is based north of the Arctic Circle in Murmansk, and that nuclear-armed submarines from Russia, the United States, and quite possibly France and the United Kingdom regularly are deployed in the Arctic Ocean. Indeed, the Arctic Ocean was a very important front line in the Cold War. And one might actually think that the Arctic Ocean is the last place on Earth where we will see the removal of nuclear weapons. But of course, the removal of nuclear weapons from everywhere on Earth is now on the table. And so think about that for a second. If we get global nuclear disarmament, we will get our Arctic nuclear weapons free zone by definition. And what we're talking about is whether we can accelerate that global process by pushing the Arctic zone a little bit ahead of that ultimate goal. There is other good news. The Arctic is, in some significant respects, already subject to nuclear weapon-free zones or equivalent declarations of one kind or another. Think of the 1971 Seabed Treaty, which means that by agreement, no country can locate nuclear weapons on the floor of the Arctic Ocean. Very important. We have that already. So there's a partial nuclear weapons-free zone for the entire Arctic Ocean dating back to 1971. We have subnational governments that have declared their territory to be nuclear weapon-free zones. The Yukon territory is a self-declared nuclear weapon-free zone. So, too, is the Northwest Territories. And that declaration was made while none of it was still part of the NWT. So at the level of territorial governments, 40% of this country constitutes self-declared nuclear weapon-free zones. Now, unfortunately, those declarations have no impact at the level of international law and very limited impact in terms of international relations, but there's certainly something that we should highlight, and we should encourage those territorial governments to renew those declarations and seek to persuade Nunavut, as the new majority Inuit governed territory of one-fifth of Canada's landmass, to do that in particular. My own sense is that the government of Nunavut might be quite receptive to this, because the Inuit, through the then Inuit Circumpolar Conference, now renamed the Inuit Circumpolar Council, have twice declared their desire to have all of their traditional territory free from nuclear arms in 1977 and 1981. And let me just read you part of their declaration from 1981. And this is the Inuit organization that represents the Inuit from Canada, Alaska, Greenland, and part of Russia. And their position is that the Arctic should be used for purposes that are peaceful and environmentally safe, that there shall be no nuclear testing or nuclear devices in the Arctic or subarctic, that there shall be no nuclear dump sites in the Arctic or subarctic, and some people will be particularly interested in this, that exploration, exploitation of uranium, thorium, lithium, or other materials related to the nuclear industry in our homeland be prohibited. Now, the Inuit Circumpolar Council is not a nation state, but it does have permanent participant status at the Arctic Council, and it has played a very important role in some aspects of international lawmaking, perhaps most notably in the development and adoption of the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, where without the leadership of Sheila Watt-Cloutier, my children and grandchildren would be destined to have much higher levels of PCBs in their bodies than will now be the case. The Inuit have been instrumental there and also obviously very important in raising public consciousness in the south and in the non-Arctic regions about the extreme impact of climate change. And I agree entirely with Mike Wallace that we need to pursue other opportunities for continuing this momentum and continuing the reach of non-nuclearization of the Arctic. As Adele said, it's obvious we should be working with the Inuit because they've been here before. And one proposal that I think needs to be highlighted was made by Franklin Griffith in 1979. And Frank, you will remember that you proposed that it be agreed through treaty that the surface of the Arctic Ocean, the surface of the water and the sea ice, be explicitly non-militarized. Not a particularly radical proposition, because the surface is non-militarized. The Canadian Navy, for instance, does not operate in the Arctic at this moment. Only the Canadian Coast Guard, a civilian agency. Most of the governmental activity on the part of other countries is done by equivalent Coast Guard-type agencies rather than the military. Even China, in terms of its presence in the Arctic, well, it's through a Chinese research icebreaker, the Snow Dragon, and not a naval vessel. We're talking here about the surface of the water, not the subsurface, not the submarines. But what an opportune moment to close off any increased militarization of the Arctic through surface navies and actually to promote an agreement that would essentially freeze the situation where it is now and then provide the verification and necessary backup to create the confidence among all of the Arctic countries that they didn't need to spend money on Arctic offshore patrol ships and other naval vessels, that there was agreement that that the Arctic should continue to be primarily a civilian domain, one of cooperation. And so, Frank, I have dusted off that paper from 3 decades ago, and perhaps you and I might work together to put this proposal into the current dynamic that's been created by Barack Obama and also by the rapidly melting sea ice. I also agree that we want to start with the Arctic states that are, in terms of nuclear weapons-free zones specifically, that are already free of nuclear weapons. We don't want to have a pretend Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, a treaty that looks really good on a headline of a newspaper, but if you read the actual provisions, doesn't amount to much. A lot is made, for instance, of some of the Southern Hemisphere treaties. But if you take, for instance, the Rarotonga Treaty and look at it closely, you'll find that it not only allows transits of nuclear weapons through that nuclear weapons-free zone, but it also allows for the launching of nuclear weapons from that zone. The only thing it really prohibits is the targeting of locations within the zone with nuclear weapons. And to my mind, that doesn't really amount to all that much. So if we're working towards an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, let's not enter into a pretend zone. Let's do incremental steps that actually mean something. And excluding, at least initially, the United States and Russia from any such zone in that context makes an awful lot of sense. We will, when we get to the stage of talking with Denmark, and with the self-government of Greenland, encounter the issue of Thule. I'm not sure whether nuclear weapons are currently deployed at Thule, but the problem there will be similar to that of Diego Garcia, the British-owned island in the Indian Ocean, which is the location of a major American base, which has caused real problems in terms of the Palindaba Treaty, the African nuclear weapons free zone. And the existence of Diego Garcia within that zone has meant that neither the United States or Russia have been able to accept that treaty for different reasons. Thule will be a sticking point. But the sticking point may actually come more in terms of problems between the government of Greenland, which represents Greenlanders who were forcibly excluded from Thule to have the base built, and the government of Denmark. And I'm looking at Steve here because the Greenlanders were very opposed to missile defense and Danish participation and the siting of a new radar facility at Thule, and they were overridden by the Danish government. But since last year, as a result of a national referendum, the Greenlanders have much more extensive powers of self-governance, so watch that space. In terms of what Mike said about the NATO strategic concept, that will cause problems for the non-nuclear weapon states in the Arctic, but perhaps the time is ripe with the Obama administration and all of the development there to either modify that concept, provide exemptions that might allow for an Arctic nuclear free zone, or perhaps simply to ignore those constraints and push forward in the spirit of what would you call that, entrepreneurship that wasn't bound or constrained by technical rules. And the same approach is one that I would like to suggest might be most appropriate in terms of the Northwest Passage. If none of it were to declare itself a nuclear weapons-free zone, or even better, if the government of Canada were to declare all of Canada a nuclear weapons-free zone, something I've advocated for a couple of years now, and I know others have been doing so for much longer, that would create an opportunity to provoke the dispute with the United States over the Northwest Passage, because if we have a nuclear weapons-free zone and we maintain our position that the Northwest Passage constitutes internal waters, then by implication, no nuclear weapons can pass through. And if we were to press the point with the United States, well, they would then come back to us with the sticking point of nuclear submarine traffics, and we would simply exacerbate that existing dispute. I've written elsewhere about ways in which we could promote cooperation and confidence building with the Americans over the Northwest Passage with a view to the eventual resolution of our legal differences. But if we're going to do an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, whether merely for none of it or for all of Canada or one that included other Arctic countries, I think the best strategy would be to simply treat any possible submarine transits as things we can't know about, because of course they are covert, and therefore we will press ahead with our nuclear weapons free zone, but we will at the same time not insist on waving the red flag in front of the American bull, and that would be a continuation of decades of practice between our two countries, where we have on most aspects of the Northwest Passage simply and for the most part quietly agreed to disagree. So in conclusion, there's a lot of good news when it comes to the Arctic. There are the elements of an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone already in place. There are territorial governments that have been pressing forward. The major indigenous organization has been on this issue for three decades now. There are fantastic proposals like that made by Franklin Griffith in 1979 that have acquired new relevance, and I'm optimistic that a great deal could be done. But I will close by saying that much of this could only be done if we had governments in this country that were willing to do so. And perhaps it will be for the government of Nunavut or for other levels of government in this country to take the lead on this. But the time is certainly ripe. The Americans are in a more progressive position on these issues than they have been for many decades. The Russians are cooperating. The only thing that, from my perspective, is missing is that traditional progressive middle power, which I call my own. Thank you.
Thanks a million, Michael. That was fantastic. Ken, do we have a laser pointer? Maybe you could rustle it. Laser pointer? Does anyone have a laser pointer? No? No? Okay. Canadian Pugwashites here and no laser pointers? I find that astounding. Come on. So many academics per square feet than any other meeting and no laser pointers. Anyway, okay, so I was just going to point out some of the features on the map that we've talked about, but we can carry on. I think we have another 20 minutes for discussion. And Michael, thank you for many of those thought-provoking suggestions, particularly around Nunavut and the symbolic declaration of that territory becoming a nuclear weapons-free zone. We co-organized a conference in September with a German organization called the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, and it was sort of the Rideau Institute's first foray into looking at issues of Arctic and particularly security, and we met with a number of indigenous organizations beforehand and consulted with them before that we did this event. And one of the things that emanated was that in many of the land claim agreements, there are foreign policy provisions there. So in fact, many indigenous groups have standings in international fora. And you mentioned the Arctic Council, a creation of Canada in the 1990s, one of the only venues that's there to discuss areas of mutual cooperation in the Arctic where indigenous organizations have representation there. The other good news I could point out, too, is, I mean, it is a conservative government in power in Canada here, but you remember what happened when a U.S. arms manufacturer tried to buy RadarSat. And the company that controlled RadarSat, a satellite that was so critical for Arctic monitoring. And out of 10,000 foreign takeovers since the 1980s, 1,600 of which had been reviewed by Industry Canada and approved, none of which had ever been stopped. Because this issue so much impinged on Canadian sovereignty and our ability to monitor the Arctic, this Harper government had to be the first government to say no to a foreign takeover of a Canadian company. And it was a remarkable turning point, and I think maybe we can find those same leverage points on this particular issue, considering that only last month a U.S. nuclear submarine surfaced in the Arctic, a new Virginia-class submarine, which actually wasn't supposed to be able to do this, but now has proven it does have the capability of doing it. And, of course, now the questions are being asked, were Canadians informed? Did it pass through our waters? Just what was the situation here? And those questions are being answered with silence from the Canadian government. So clearly they are sensitive on this issue. I'm happy now to spend the next time entertaining questions for our panelists, and I think you folks could probably take it from there. Does anyone want to lead off with any questions? Go ahead, Dale.
Oops, Dale Dewar, Physicians for Global Survival. I have worked in Tuktoyaktuk and Inuvik, and in the 1996 area when they were first saying that it was warming too fast. So that's a bit of time under the road. But I have a couple of questions that are kind of trivial. The understanding is that we have established in a peaceful manner the rights to our Arctic or our ocean shelf, is that correct? The 200-mile limit?
Go ahead and maybe pose both your questions and then we'll
It's a case of what territory have we established that is, quote, under each country's control? Okay. At one point I saw a picture or a diagram showing that each country claim the land roughly up to the North Pole as somehow being under their territorial agreement. So I'm just wondering about land claims in the Arctic. And a second one, which is totally, totally trivial, and that is there's a difference between nuclear-powered submarines and nuclear-powered submarines that carry nuclear weapons. Now, I guess I have a sort of a secret concern about submarines in general. Do they actually serve a purpose other than military? And in such a way, how many of those do we really need to be seen running around under the ice? So there's two questions hidden in there.
Okay. Michael, could you take the first one, and then maybe I'll ask the other Michael to deal with the difference between attack submarines and missile submarines.
There is.
On the first question, the facetious answer is buy a copy of Who Owns the Arctic, because this is what I try to explain, and there's an awful lot of very technical international law that I've tried to make accessible to non-lawyers. The simple answer is twofold. First of all, there's only one dispute over land territory anywhere in the Arctic, and that concerns Hans Island, 1.3 square kilometers. That's the only land dispute anywhere in the circumpolar Arctic. And the only reason we dispute that is because it's convenient for Danish or Canadian politicians to fly there just before their national election campaigns. It has no relevance whatsoever. I've sat down with a Danish ambassador, and on the back of a napkin, we have literally cut the island in half. I wish I'd been representing the Canadian government, because we would have solved the dispute in just a couple of minutes. It's irrelevant. There are disputes over maritime issues, although far fewer disputes of much less significance than you might think, because under the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention, which Canadian diplomats played a lead role in negotiating, coastal states have absolute rights out to 12 nautical miles and certain sovereign rights, including exclusive rights over the seabed, out to 200 nautical miles everywhere. And if they can demonstrate a so-called natural prolongation beyond 200 nautical miles, their sovereign rights can go further. And the natural prolongation test is fulfilled by scientific criteria concerning the shape and the character of the sediments. 95% of the Arctic Ocean seabed is going to fall without any contestation within one or another of the coastal states' jurisdiction. And what remains are a few overlaps. There's an overlap in the Beaufort Sea between Canada and the United States. There's a very small overlap between Canada and Denmark, north of Ellesmere Island and Greenland. There's an overlap in the Barents Sea. Russia and Norway are negotiating that right now, and they have made some early progress. There would have been an overlap in the Bering Strait and the Chukchi Sea, except for the fact that the Soviet Union and the United States agreed on a maritime boundary in 1990 there. And there's a potential overlap in the central Arctic Ocean. And as I've mentioned, lawyers from all five foreign ministries have been meeting to discuss how to resolve that. There's no gold rush. There's no big contest here. And indeed, even those disputes are of significantly lesser consequence, because most of the oil and gas is located fairly close into shore in shallow water. So everyone can calm down about that. Everything's working according to the plan that Canadian diplomats had in the early 1980s. The final thing, just to jump into the beginning part of the question for Mike, there are nuclear-powered ships in the Arctic that are not military. Those are icebreakers, Russian icebreakers, and I'm certainly not proposing that we should seek to prohibit nuclear-powered icebreakers engaged in commercial activity from using the North. That's part of Russia's existing infrastructure.
Adele, did you want to just add one PS before we move to the submarine question?
Quickly go. Well, I don't know about a PS, but in response to two or three different things. One, I believe that you can confirm this, that we were given to understand in Thule that there are no nuclear weapons there, that is a thing of the past. So that's one point. The other is I'm surprised, Michael, and I'm very pleased to hear how much attention the Inuit people have paid to nuclear weapons already and not wanting anything to do with them. And I think in view of Mayor Akiba's discussion with us, it would also be helpful if most of those communities were part of the Mayors for Peace group. So that's just a comment. And my next point here is more kind of just a speculation, but the 1971 Seabed Treaty, maybe someone knows if submarines make use of the seabed in some way. And could that be construed as using the seabed and therefore violating the treaty?
Anyway, this is kind of a wild
question. I'm going to ask Mike to take that because I don't know whether they actually rest on the bottom or not, Mike. But could you explain the difference between hunter-killers and missile subs and answer maybe that question?
Well, let's start with a very important distinction between what are called fast attack submarines, which are basically designed to hunt and find and destroy surface or other submarines. They're relatively small, which doesn't really mean small. It can be up to 6,000 tons submerged displacement. They used to carry nuclear cruise missiles during the dark days of the Cold War. But the Bush-Gorbachev agreement of 1991 was not a formal treaty, but just an executive agreement prohibited the carrying of those cruise missiles because along with the INF treaty, these were regarded as a very dangerous, provocative kind of thing to have given how close the fast attack submarines could approach the coast and stealthily fire. So these were taken off, and as far as I know, neither side has gone back on that agreement. Certainly the Americans haven't. I have reason to know that. Now, the other kind of submarine are the ballistic missile firing submarines. These are very much larger. The ones in service in the United States now are the upgrade of the Trident, the D5 upgrade of the Trident II. They're up to 20,000 tons displacement, which is really used to be considered a pretty good small cargo ship in the old days. Fairly large things. They're a couple of football fields long. And the thing about them, and this is very important, is the notion that they're going to be able to maneuver in the narrow waters, places like the Northwest Passage or various straits in and around the Arctic waters, is ludicrous because their mission is to move around, go to their patrol boxes, and be entirely stealthy. Their entire job is not to exist from the point of view of the other side and not be able to be discovered by their sonar or any other method. They practice this going ultra quiet, incredibly, at least on the American side, certainly do. And after the Walker spy scandal woke up the Russians how noisy their subs were, Russians also moved in that direction very quickly. And these big behemoths make incredibly little noise. They make less noise than a transistor radio played underwater at 100 kilometers distance. They're very, very quiet indeed. Anechoic tiles, I could go into all the technical stuff. The point is, however, they're too big to maneuver in tight spaces. Because if they did, then they might get into a situation where they'd have to get out of the way quickly. And they're long, they're narrow, they have a high polar moment of inertia.
Do they use the seabed?
Not usually. There's no reason to. There's no reason to be down on the bottom. They need to hover. In order to fire their missiles, they have to hover at a depth of approximately 150 meters and simply turn their engines off and hover, as they call it. And then the tubes can open. The point being that if they were to maneuver in tight spaces, their propeller, there's only one, would make noise. What happen would be if you had hard astern or hard aport or something like this, the propeller would cavitate, which is a fancy naval word for making bubbles. The bubbles are incredibly noisy by submarine standards.
Okay.
So you simply would not do that.
That's
the point. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we are actually, the session is very brief. We're just about out. So let me take a round of questions, if I can, very quickly, just to get a whole bunch of things out on the table, and I'll ask for very short concluding remarks from each person, starting with Gordon.
Gordon Edwards again. I appreciated all this information. It's very, very good. I wonder if anybody has given thought to the nuclear weapon that's already on the ocean floor at Thule, the one that was not retrieved from the bomber that crashed in the 1950s. They retrieved three of the nuclear weapons, but a fourth one went down to the bottom and was never retrieved. So there is, in fact, a nuclear weapon sitting on the bottom. And I wonder whether this might be a good point to urge the international or the American recovery of this lost nuclear weapon. It might also be a way of dramatizing to the general public around the world the importance of this issue of nuclear weapons in the Arctic, the fact that this weapon is sitting there.
Mm. Thanks. Good point. Franklin?
It's a very interesting discussion. I'd say two little things. One is that in setting up a campaign, launching a campaign for an Arctic nuclear weapons-free zone, there is a danger. And the danger is that of playing into the nationalist and, shall I say, militarist point of view, which is that there's all kinds of danger, threat, menace, conflict potential in the Arctic. And you'll risk, I think, to start speaking the language of those who want to spend more on defense, who want stronger, more capable Arctic offshore patrol vessels. There was a piece in yesterday's Globe and Mail, an op-ed by Rob Hubert to that effect. That is polar peril stuff, which does not help. Somehow in doing a campaign, Pugwash or whoever is behind the campaign is going to have to find a way to speak sensibly about the issues. And I think Michael Byers has part of the answer, and that is there is a rule of law that prevails in the Arctic, and we should not in any way subvert that by emphasizing danger. As I read or skim the paper that you and Michael Wallace did, this paper verges into polar peril. It's talking about militarization. It's underway. Jayantha Dhanapala is quoted at the very end of here on page whatever is 13, that there could be conflict leading to the use of nuclear weapons. This is not the way we should talk about the region. The other small thing I would say is that in thinking about a demilitarized zone in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, we have a first step that could lead toward nuclear weapons status for the region. Outside or beyond the exclusive economic zones, no surface ships of any navy would be allowed. Instead, you would have, I think, Coast Guard vessels allowed. These are sometimes military. The Chinese Coast Guard runs military vessels. The Danes, the Norwegians also. Ours aren't. But you'd have to allow for some military vessels. You would also, if you think about it, have to allow for some use of submarines in an emergency. If they were the nearest to a vessel that was in distress within or near the Arctic, near the North Pole, if they're nearest, well, they should well surface through the ice, break the ice, and come up and give assistance. So there's a whole set of qualifications on a demilitarized zone that would allow for some military uses, indeed some nuclear appearance. Nevertheless, we need, I think, first steps rather than the large act, to my way of thinking about it, of a nuclear weapons-free zone. The paper here that I just mentioned does talk about first steps, and I think perhaps a demilitarized zone, as I did say many years ago, and actually I let it drop, nobody was interested. Maybe now's the time to run with this again, and if Michael wants to run, let him run.
I think he did run a couple years ago, didn't he? Thank you, Frank. That was excellent, and thank you for the comments on the paper. I'm deferring to the conference chair at this point because I know there's a number of other comments, but I'll defer to Meta at this point.
I think what we have to do now, there's hardly time for people to go out. You can stand and do a seventh inning stretch the way you would in a baseball game, and if you've got to go to the washroom, run. And come back, because we have to start very quickly with the next session, because we are paying $700 an hour for the room to get this lady on our program.
Very good reminder. Well, let me, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask our panelists to stick around if you can and take any questions. Would you be able to do that, Michael and Michael, Adele, would that be okay? You could stay around and take some questions. And please thank you for your excellent questions, and join me in thanking our panelists for their presentations today.